Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the multi-talented researcher, poet, performance artist, and author Quentin Anna Wixwo. A former human rights worker, Wixwo used salvaged old typewriters and old cameras to navigate unexpected corners of the world, obscure places where she reveals a multi-layered complexity of time, space, and emotional history. Many locations are forgotten or overlooked sites where crimes against humanity have taken place. Wixwo writes stories from these places, attempting to put words to the places themselves and the people who have inhabited them, bridging in her work the liminality of human experience, making stories that read like poems with images that don't serve to illustrate the text but really deepen the reader's feel of it. Of this wonderful book, author Ricky Ducournay writes, "These stunning solitary and cinematic letters to the self bear witness to a world beloved and betrayed, the spent and brutal collisions of irretrievable loss with what might have been possible." That is coming up right now in our discussion with the author and investigative artist, Quentin Anna Wixwo. Stick around. Quentin Anna Wixwo is a writer and visual artist whose work integrates fiction, poetry, memoir, and essay with her photographs, performances, and films. Her works have been published, performed, and exhibited throughout the world and can be found in anthologies, artists' books, magazines such as Tin House, Guernica, Conjunctions, The Kenyon Review, and many, many others. A human rights worker for 2 decades, she now uses salvaged government typewriters and cameras to navigate known, unknown, and occluded worlds, especially obscured sites where crimes against humanity have taken place. Quentin Anna Wixwo, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Tim. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure to finally have a chance to talk with you about this amazing book, The Hope of Floating, has carried us this far with Coffee House Press. But also, and mostly, actually, I'm really excited to talk with you a lot about the work you've been doing that sort of has informed the book, but just the work you're doing all around the world. It's fascinating. So congratulations first on all that.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Let's see, where are you calling us from today?
Outside of Santa Fe.
Oh, okay.
Half an hour outside of Santa Fe in the desert.
Wow, in the desert.
Looking out at some petroglyphs.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because aren't you're originally from Brooklyn, right?
No, I'm originally from the Southwest and then was living in Brooklyn for a while and I come back home.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yeah, right. My next question was going to be, what brings you then to the Southwest, you know?
I've been coming home. Here my whole life. And then once Trump came in, I wanted to be back home.
I wanted
to be back where I belong. Like, there's work to be done.
Totally. You're like, yeah, something's calling me the other way.
Yeah.
Right on. Is this your first book? Is that right?
Yes.
Right, and you got it. Yeah, you landed that with Coffee House Press, which is a fantastic, reputable press. And you know, they always do such daring, risk-taking books. Is there any? What was the process like working with them?
Oh, it was really fantastic. Their former acquiring editor Anitra Budd is just fearless, mm-hmm. and she came and heard me read in New York and just said, "What do you have? Whatever you have, I want to publish." And I had written this collection, not really thinking it was. It's so strange. It's poetry and it's fiction and it's photographs and the form is odd. And so they made the entire book from my heart's desire come true on the page exactly as I had envisioned it, which I think is quite rare.
Yes.
Quite rare for that to happen.
It is. And you know what? I mean, it really is. And I know going back and forth with editors sometimes can be a little taxing and also a little nerve-wracking because you're right. You have, as the author, have a very, and even more than just an author, but also the fact that, you're an investigator, a performance artist, all of these other things that you're trying to, you know, sort of create an entirely, almost a new genre or at least a hybridity. And how, you know, so the nerves come in. I mean, I know that. And so the nerves come in going, are they going to get my vision right? Is it going to, you know, so that's cool when they do get that, right? When you have that sort of alignment.
The more pieces that have to be pulled into the puzzle, then you see them all assembled, and it's like, oh, there's communion with other humans who actually are interested in what I'm interested in.
Totally, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the book has been described, for our listeners out there, the book's been described as a successfully ambitious bending of form that takes the reader beyond the expected in literature and art. The book, as I said, is a hybridity of work, form, imagery, and narrative, and poetry, which encourages the reader to explore subjects in new ways. Now, how would you describe the book yourself to our listeners?
Well, I would describe the book as the really conversations, and my work in general, I would say, the performance work. I've been a human rights worker since I was a teenager. They're conversations it's really conversations with the dead in a lot of ways, and narrating and telling stories as I see and hear them from places and people and situations that have been usually intentionally overlooked. So that's why I was kind of surprised to find it published, because it's years and years of going to particular places and just listening and watching and getting to know people and accumulating these stories. So to me, it's very much a book about resistance and justice and people who have said, we will not go away. There may have been genocide. There may have been any number of crimes against us, but we will not go away. And, you know, in my belief system, spirits and ghosts are perfectly reliable people to interview.
Yes, no, for sure, for sure.
So this book is for them.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, why don't we give our listeners a taste, and would you mind just sharing an excerpt of the book with us right now?
Sure. I have a piece in the book called Kolodnaya Vojna Club, which is Russian for the Cold War Club. It's about pilots, test war pilots who crashed, and they all find themselves in this sort of limbo together. And it was written for a very good friend of mine who was a test pilot who crashed in New Mexico. So here's an excerpt. Although we could as easily seat ourselves by branch of service or by aircraft, in our earliest meetings, we instinctively calibrate ourselves according to ideology. Geopolitical affiliation is at first divisive. There are sharp disputes. The North Koreans confront the French. The Americans accuse the Cubans. Confusion mixed with cultivated hostility forms the basis of aggression. Often, we have killed one another, either directly or through a causal chain of events, and that escalates the tensions. Most questions we cannot answer, and stymied by the failure of conversation, we begin to hit each other. Our wounds get in the way. We shyly coalesce into groups corresponding to fatal injury, skull fracture, stroke, drowning, asphyxiation, hemorrhage, burns. This is what starts us thinking and talking about women.
There's so much there that I want to pick apart. And, you know, so thank you. And if you're just tuning in, for your listeners who are just tuning in, we are actually speaking with the author, Quentin Anna Wixwo, about her new book, The Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far. That excerpt that you just read, there's so much. Like I said, one of the lines that sticks out to me immediately is this, the line where you read, confusion mixed with cultivated hostility forms the basis of aggression. And isn't that like, I mean, isn't that what we're seeing now? Isn't that what's rampant now?
A big part. Yeah.
You know, the confusion that's being stirred up and how, you know, that forms the basis of aggression. It's incredible. And then also our wounds get in the way. Can you talk a little bit about that line?
Well, I think one of the reasons the title, The Hope of Floating, is very much about healing and all that. But at the same time, I don't really believe that wounds fully heal. And I've made a series of T-shirts that say one day our wounds will not get in our way. And I think in these stories and in our entire world, and certainly in our country, we're all influenced by these wounds that keep us from actually getting to the deep emotion, deep beliefs, and deep scars that are there. Mm-hmm. And that's what I care about very much, and that's what the book is about. And as the pilots kind of realize, wait a minute, we've been told things about each other.
Yeah.
We've been conditioned to treat each other in a certain way, but then they start talking about the women that they were in love with and the things that happened in their lives, and they find these commonalities that don't erase the difference, but it changes the wound to be something deeply intimate that can actually be shared.
Right.
There's something about sharing that wound and having it listened to and respected and heard that I think is going to be immensely It is our only hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the way that the book is written, and of course our listeners can't see this, but it's really, I mean, it's broken up. The lines are broken. Sometimes it turns into stanzas. It's poetry. It's also, you know, narrative, sort of prosaic. One of the things that I love about the entire book actually is this, the ambiguity that you leave us hanging with in these lines, you know, because as you said, this is a conversation among pilots. And yet, you know, these lines, the way that they're broken up on the page, like our wounds get in the way, or this is what starts us talking about women, can be read entirely different contexts in different ways because of the way you've placed them on the page, because of the poetry. Mm. So that's one of the reasons why I'm really fascinated by what you've done here. Yeah.
Thank you.
And you mentioned before you read that excerpt, you mentioned that your writing or your books or your work is about people who say we will not go away. And I know you started doing human rights work early on. How did you get into human rights work first?
Well, I was from California, and then we ended up in the Deep South, and I didn't go to school. I lived in the middle of absolutely nowhere in the Deep South. And so since I didn't go to school, I sort of wandered around. And the people who essentially adopted me were the veteran civil rights workers, some of the first just everyday people who marched in Selma and who did the lunch counter sit-ins and were with, you know, small town desegregating a swimming pool. So these were just kind of people who will never go down in history with a name attached to them. Right. And there was something, we would go places and they would say, oh, that's the street corner where so-and-so got lynched. You know, and from just the earliest age, it was this idea that that person didn't go away. That was a living, breathing man.
Yes.
And there were people that were going to remember. And from then on, it just, I mean, I went up, you know, to working with Amnesty International and major global organizations, but nothing ever got in the way of that echo that I constantly hear of, you know, there could be genocide and we are not going to. We're not going to go silently into the night, and I want to be part of that very, very much.
Right. I'm a big believer in that, you know, that space holds memory. And, you know, I know that the, you know, that human rights work, I did my research on you, gosh, months ago, when I first got turned on to the book about the book Hope of Floating Has Carried Us This Far. And, you know, for our listeners out there, too, I really encourage them to look up some of your YouTube presentations that you've done, you know, across the country on this work, because it's really multimedia and just important work that we need, you know, that I think it just needs to be out there as far and wide as possible. But, you know, some of the things, I guess, to highlight some of the work that you've done, just for our listeners, I know you've gone, to give you an example, you've gone to a clinical wing at the NYU hospital where people have been forced into electroshock, or you've gone to an Arizona grocery store where sex traffickers were bought and sold toddlers. I mean, just these really sort of tormented physical spaces. What do you do when you're there in these spaces? Tell our listeners what your work is about.
I do not like parachuting into places. So usually when I find, I spend a lot of time, months to years, and sometimes it's a space, you know, like the convenience store, grocery store that's, you know, 500 feet by 500 feet. And I take a typewriter with me because I don't need electricity. And I just listen and watch. And there's always some personal tie. There's always some part of my history or my heritage that has led me to those places. So the pieces unfold as kind of a kaleidoscope of listening to contemporary people speaking and also just noticing tiny details and trying to illuminate. You're right. Space does hold memory, and it often really holds traces. I mean, there are artifacts in one way or another that are almost always still there.
Yeah.
And so that's where, like, the photographs and everything come in. And a lot of times I go and I intentionally am a bit conspicuous. I use these really old cameras from usually military cameras and really old military typewriters. And so people are drawn to, why is this person in this place? And so there are folks who remember what happened, and because I'm approachable, they'll kind of come up and say, let me tell you about my grandfather. You know, did you know that this happened here? And it's incredibly moving. And over the course of 6 months or a year, the number of people that just sort of walk by and say, you're looking at that window for a reason. Did you know that that's where so many people died of AIDS being hidden away, or, you know?
Right. So the memory is still stored there among the community itself.
Right. And I don't think there's often a forum in the community or in a family, you know, whether that's, you know, a nation or a tribe or a religious group or whatever. It's often there's no forum in the larger society for those memories and those injustices to be spoken about, particularly not with respect, I think, has been one of the things that has struck me. You know, like, oh, they deserved it. They were in the way. Right. This was our country to begin with. Whatever it was that justified whatever this human rights crime or this thing, there's a brutality that I think keeps people silent because their memories and are sacred.
Yeah.
You know, these are actual human beings who suffered, and the suffering is carried through families. It is carried through a small town where you come from outside and you don't know that no one takes that road without saying a little prayer at the intersection or so, you know.
Right.
That's what I think needs to be heard, so that when people are able to speak or are able to start talking about these wounds, there's humility and there's a sense of treading lightly and being respecting something sacred.
Right. And, you know, how do you, because, you know, it seems like the tools that you have in your toolkit to do all this work ranges from obviously poetry to performance to even anthropology or ethnography, oral history, all of that is included in this, documentation, all of that. And how do you take, you know, this information, say there's one case here that where you went to a redwood grove where senators incited lynch mobs. And so, you know, so say when you're at these kind of spaces and you start to record this information, how do you turn that into the text, this sort of book that you have? How does that, what's that process like?
It feels like transcription. It feels like just listening and taking notes. Most of what I did, and a lot of my job as a human rights worker, was to take the oral testimonies of survivors of genocide and crimes against humanity. So I did a lot of listening and writing to what people said. And some was very articulate and very organized and very detached. And I am making a report. And then there would be moments where emotion, people would completely break down and language would become distorted and sentences wouldn't be completed and someone would go back into circular motion and be stuck and retell the same phrase 6 and 7 and 8 times. So I noticed that there was this language pattern around trauma, and then I have my own extensive history with trauma. And I think, like, what one of the projects that I'm working on now out here is doing human rights work, and I was kidnapped and sexually assaulted and then kind of dumped in the desert. And I avoided that for a long time and then decided to go back and do the small autobiographical project. But what happened was all of these other people started talking about their experiences of similar things. And right. So I wrote what would be a journal entry, you know, how right. I felt. And so that's a fragment. And then I talk with someone and I get their permission. Like, can I use this phrase that you use? Right. Like, yes, I mean, I always get permission. And then a lot of it is just is sitting. I mean, I sit for hours and hours and hours. I've probably, right. It's been 6 years on the Desert Project, and I just sit and I listen. So that goes into the typewriter. And those are fragments that I think that then becomes a performance script. I sit with a pile of video cameras and a pile of really crummy cameras. I'm not a. But, they never work. They're always defective. All the tools I use are about like they're all garage sales. So nothing ever works properly. And I think
that's great.
That's really one of the key things to my process is that like nothing works properly.
Yes.
There are always surprises either in the tools themselves or I come back and there's a video and things show up on it, or there's strange aspects to the image quality. So that'll be a projection
right.
that will go on stage. Like the tour that I did for this book was on my films, and then I worked with different composers and they created live music scores, and then I would read when other people would weave their voices.
That's fantastic. And, you know, that's one of the things that is really interesting to me is then the sort of the multimedia or multidisciplinary, approach that you have to all of these. And it seems to me, and of course, you know, I may be totally projecting. I'm sure I'm projecting here, but it seems to me that you know, the way that you're approaching this is to just utilize every tool in the toolkit that you have at your disposal to document, to record. As you say, I think you said this in one of your presentations that I saw on YouTube, but it's easy to hide the site of atrocity, just remove the evidence and don't let anyone talk about what happened there. And to me, you know, then this sort of recording of evidence or this sort of revisiting of these incidents is part of, you know, reclaiming that situation. And you're using all of these mediums as the tool to do that.
Absolutely. And I think I've always been, you know, you've been a history buff. But there's something about the feel. It's the same as like the way I feel about kind of decolonizing literature.
Yes.
It's like decolonizing a lot of fields where history has become something where there's an official record and you cite your sources and you have footnotes and it's all very, but there are no senses there. And I have, and almost everybody I've ever worked with has had very severe PTSD. Mm-hmm. And what happens with that is all your senses are hyperactivated.
Right.
And I would read something that either I was involved in or witnessed or knew about and then say, but that's not what it was like because the sun was burning hot. You know, there was this odor or so much to me is creating, using as many artistic tools as possible to use our, to activate the senses that are missing from that kind of sterile museum institutional quality of how we learn about time and place and people. And then there's a universality when I can have the opportunity to share a book or to share a performance. It's recreating a site, but people can enter through their senses.
Right.
So if you've ever been really, really cold, or if you've ever, if your legs have ever shaken in fear, or if you've ever cried at the passing of a loved one or been scared of something, that emotion comes through far more viscerally, and I think leaving more, again, connecting kind of wound to wound than reading it passively in a history book that some terrible things happened to some poor people a long time ago.
Right.
And I want to collapse time to realize, like, there's a serious continuity of what human nature is like and how we respond to injustice and how the earth holds our sorrows.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned this hyperactive sort of the senses on a sort of hyper alert or hyper awareness, you know, and that's one of the things that even when I teach workshops on this kind of approach to, you know, collecting material, there is that there are all the tools that we have at our disposal. And at the same time, we can't discount, like we should never discount, right, this sort of full body awareness. So even the five senses or even the sixth sense, when we go into spaces, how do we use our body also as the main tool to collect information? That is, you know, what are we hearing and what are we, all these, we have to have, I think, our senses on hyper alert or hyper awareness. And it sounds like that's, you know, along the lines of what you're doing here, going into these spaces, right? I mean, the tools
are
one thing.
And honoring it, honoring that we are bodies in space.
Right.
And you see something and you're going to get sick to your stomach. You know, you're scared enough or you see something and then that somehow gets left out. But
Absolutely. Actually
that's the human animal.
Absolutely.
Responding. And
Absolutely.
And that's also a passage into healing. I mean, I believe I've gotten a lot of help through somatic experiencing and a lot of like therapy where you're actually able to talk about like everyone in my family has these back problems. And it's like, well, you look at something that happened to that family and a lot of it is passed in the memory of that particular family. And you can go back in and say, why when I go to, you know, how come every single time I go to Phoenix, I get sick to my stomach
No, that's right. You know, that's the first visceral reaction I had when I was doing this research on this plane crash and I went to the crash site, crossed through the barbed wire. And as soon as I started to get to this crash site, I started to feel sick to my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just this sort of, that was sort of the immediate intuitive reaction. But, you know, I want to go back to this idea of decolonializing form that you mentioned or decolonizing form in terms of the book itself, because your book, again, as I've mentioned, and I can't say this enough, it's, you know, for lack of a better word, it's a hybrid, but I don't like calling it a hybrid either. I just feel like it's what it is. You know, like this is the sort of fluid human narrative artistic endeavor that all I think books should be about, you know. course, you know, being a fan of that myself. And I know that you mentioned earlier in one of our previous conversations that, you know, you see the book as nonfiction, but because it had all these fabulous elements, they called it fiction. And I've dealt with that same issue too. But can you talk about then, you know, how the sort of pushing the envelope in text has been for you?
I've just stuck to it. And it's funny because for a while I started sending work out just to editors and would laugh at where they would decide to put it.
Right.
You know, I'm like, okay, so you've decided it's poetry. You've decided it's going to go in the fiction section. You've decided it, you know. But I think there's so much attention to these rules around where narrative belongs and what form it can take. And even little things that bother me, like having to put, you know, everything in English is in normal font, and then anything that's not in English has to be italicized, as though that's, you know, like we're just letting you know something's a little different.
Yeah, exactly.
And why does that have to be set off? Like, I don't ever use quote marks because I don't feel when I'm speaking with someone, our voices are mingling, and it's you can hardly tell who's speaking a lot of them. You talk over each other. Everything in little categories. And that, to me, is such a colonialist act of, like, separation and segregation and defining and pinning down. And I just want to take all those little pins out. I think I wasn't educated. I never took an English class in my entire life. I have an MFA, you know, and later I ended up going to college, but I didn't grow up with any formal education. I was never taught how to use a camera. I think there's so many barriers that are erected to, you can't actually tell your story. You can't share your experience, and your voice will not be heard until you learn the rules. And by the way, the people who established these rules lived in, England in the 16th century. And that may be totally irrelevant to you, but you're going to have to figure that out before you get to speak. That's not right anymore. I don't think that's what those people intended. I don't think they intended to make the entire globe. I mean, some did, obviously, but these barriers that are erected really, I think, influence the number of people who have. I work in juvenile detention centers out here, and a lot of the with girls, and a lot of them will say things like, "Well, I can't write because I don't spell." You think I can spell? There are these barriers that lead towards silencing, but are actually a form of either continuing a genocide or continuing a colonization. And I really think breaking down, things don't need to be perfect, and we don't need to follow all these rules that are set our own rules as an artist, set your own rules as a human being, as a witness, as an activist, as a mourner. No one can tell you how to grieve. They can make 6 steps, but you're going to go through your grief process.
Right.
It should be the same way with writing or any form of art. This is my process, and
I agree.
I
agree. I once joked with a friend. I said, we didn't cross the genre. The genre crossed us. But this idea of, how the colonization of form is still playing out in us. And, I always feel like my whole job is just to blow open all those borders and boundaries as much as possible and get to as close to the human experience as I can in writing. And you certainly have been doing that for some time now in your work and also in this wonderful book, The Hope of Floating, has carried us this far. We're actually out of time now. It's so fast. I know my producer's telling us we're out of time. And I'm going, oh my God, already? We barely got going here. I'm sorry to have to cut this a little bit short, Quentin, but do you have a very small piece that you can maybe just take us out with? We can conclude on something that's kind of a brief excerpt.
This is one from women who are surviving a famine after a genocide. Pray to be turned into a blanket, a hat, a pair of socks, anything that comforts. Pray for what now gives way, that it someday hold. Pray that bones that will bend instead of break are prayers for our bodies to be soaked in vinegar, pickled, unable to expire. Pray for good winds. Pray for calm skies, for our immortality. As often as possible, pray for something that does not yet exist.
We have been speaking with the author and brilliant artist, Quentin Anna Wixwo, about her book, The Hope of Floating, has carried us this far. It's out with Coffee House Press. It's a remarkable book, and her work is fascinating. I encourage you to look it up and pick up the book. You won't be disappointed. Thank you so much, Quentin, for joining us today on Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Thanks, everybody.
Absolutely. Take care of yourself and keep up the great work.
Thanks. You too.
We'd like to thank our guest today, the multi-talented artist and human rights worker Quentin Anna Wixwo, whose book, The Hope of Floating, has carried us this far, is out with Coffee House Press. You want to be sure to pick it up. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our wonderful, magical producer, Kimberly Garcia, behind the board there. And I'm Tim Hernandez. We'll see you next week, same time and same place, KTEP 88.5 FM.